very interesting to me. I'm interested in how you came to do. Well, first, just sort of just a description. What do you do? What do you do on a daily basis? You know, you're newly elected supervisor.
Right, I'm the newly elected supervisor, and so the types of activities that I'm involved with in the town these days are, a lot of it's budget. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, right now I'm negotiating the CSEA contract. That's a union. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The workers have a union. Mm-hmm. We also have the PBA contract, which is the Police Benevolent mm-hmm. Association, and so we're in negotiations with that right now. But some of the stuff that I like to do is I met yesterday with a couple of officials that are energy specialists. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to see if we can do a preliminary assessment to see where the town can save some money by going green. Mm-hmm. And the types of things that we're going to look at are changing out all our light fixtures, maybe insulating our roof. We have a leaky roof, and that's what caused me to do this. Is it would cost us about $500,000 to replace our roof. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, seeing we have to go out and lay out those kinds of expenditures, I thought it might be wise to look at what it would cost to put solar panels mm-hmm. on the roof. Mm-hmm. So not just redoing the mm-hmm. roof, but getting solar panels on it. But the low-hanging fruit in terms of energy cost savings right now are just in the insulation. You know, if we're going to put a roof on, the first thing we'll do is insulate, mm-hmm. then put the roof on, then put solar panels on top of it. Mm-hmm. But to go along with that, the building's 20 years old, so we need to look at maybe changing the light fixtures mm-hmm. as well and mm-hmm. reduce the energy demands. And then I went down to the highway garage, and we have two other buildings, a Parks and Rec building and a highway garage, and the same type of thing. So we're going to look at all of our energy possibilities. Mm-hmm. One of the other thoughts that we might look at is geothermal mm-hmm. For heating and cooling mm-hmm. because we sit along Butternut Creek, and groundwater's low and the soil's moist, so it might mm-hmm. be feasible mm-hmm. in terms of cost effectiveness to look at geothermal. Mm-hmm. And so that's mm-hmm. you know, my environmental background and bringing to bear with the mm-hmm. with the town government.
Yeah, and this is something that sort of struck me. It seemed like you wanted your administration to be about
a couple of things. Mm-hmm. One, environmental, and the other is openness. Mm-hmm. You know, we want the government to be. So we've restructured board meetings. We have a public comment period at the uh-huh. beginning of the meeting where people can come to the board, sign in, and say their mm-hmm. concerns, their piece, whatever they want to address to the town board before the board starts its regularly scheduled agenda. Mm-hmm. And then we've posted our meeting minutes and our agendas on the website. Mm-hmm. We've kind of modernized the government. Mm-hmm. One of my frustrations as town councilor for 10 years was we'd have meetings every other Monday, and I wouldn't get my agenda till late on Saturday afternoon. Mm-hmm. So any item on the agenda that was not that we needed to educate ourselves to or find out some information first or do an analysis, you only had Sunday, which mm-hmm. is typically a family day mm-hmm. for me, mm-hmm. and then Monday, which usually ran into work right. issues, and so I had very little time to prepare. Mm-hmm. So actually, we've gotten away from snail mail, mm-hmm. and we're doing things by email. Mm-hmm. I now approve the agenda on Wednesday, mm-hmm. by the end of business day Wednesday, and the board has it by the end of Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And so they have Thursday, Friday, and the whole week, and mm-hmm. Monday to prepare mm-hmm. themselves for any agenda items. So, I mean, that modernization has helped us in terms of efficiency, mm-hmm. and it's a cost savings measure, and it also helps us be more open to the public, because anybody that wants those agendas can put themselves on a listserv. Mm-hmm. And we have planning board, zoning board, town board now, that you can go to our website and mm-hmm. find the next meeting agenda before. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we're trying to be again, much more open and public friendly. We mm-hmm. want to notice the public of any ongoing projects or initiatives. It's our intent to bring major decisions to vote mm-hmm. and to mm-hmm. referendum. Mm-hmm. One of the things I'm looking at is the potential consolidation of the receiver of taxes office in the town clerk's office. Mm-hmm. And if that is something that we're going to pursue, I'd like to put it to the voters. You know, let them decide. But it could be a politically hot potato, and that the current receiver of taxes has been there a long time, and he's of the opposite party than I am. And so, should he decide to run again, and I put this to referendum, it's going to be a the opposition party may not see that as a benefit. Consolidating those offices. I see it as a cost savings measure. But you know, it could have its controversies.
So would you describe yourself as a politician by profession?
Well, I'm turning into that. But no, I love my day job. I started out as, you know, high school biology and chemistry teacher. I went on to grad school. I got a PhD. I worked at the Syracuse Research Corporation as an environmental chemist. I later worked at O'Brien and Gear and headed their ecological resources group, and did most of my career has been a combination of biology and chemistry. And I published 5 books, and we've got you know, a number of papers, and I published for the EPA and the National Library of Medicine and the Agency for Toxic Substance and Disease Registry, and all of that centers around the effects of chemicals in the environment. But once a chemical is released, what's the impact on the ecosystem? And and I love that. You know, that's been my career. And what drew me into politics was just that. One of the first environmental controversies in this region that I can remember was the incinerator. And so one of my friend's father was a town councilor for years, and when we were kids we used to distribute his literature at campaign time and go put up signs for him and all that kind of stuff. Well, you know, as I became older and became a professional in the environmental field, he would call me on issues, and so he called me on the incinerator issue, and he had me look at several of the proposals and so on. And so I came out against the incinerator, and the town of DeWitt's government ended up doing that at the time, but then the incinerator got moved to the town of Onondaga just over the border. And so it became a reality anyways. And then follow up on the incinerator.
So DeWitt decided to do it.
No,
not to do it.
Not to do it. DeWitt did not do it. But I, behind the scenes, I was working with Jim Guyette, who unfortunately passed away. And the reason I'm mentioning him is he's the force that brought me into politics. He was a town councilor for years. I was friends with his sons. I grew up knowing him, and he got elected to supervisor. And when he got elected to supervisor, he asked me to run for his vacated board seat. And so I figured, oh, heck, this is going to be easy. He'll be there to be the supervisor. And, and before my first election, he passed away from a severe heart complication. He had an operation scheduled and stuff. And so, in fact, when I went to the hospital to see him, I remember one of my quotes was, if you pass away, this will be the first case where the living haunts the dead. Because I didn't want to be on the town board without him, without his, you know. And so anyways, what I thought would be rather easy because I'd have coaching and training turned into a 10-year long journey where, you know, now I find myself the supervisor. But I never intended or had a path towards politics. You know. In fact, I guess my opinion of politicians has probably changed because I'm now on this side of the fence and been here 10 years, but I had a rather dark or jaded view of politicians, and for a long time it was not easy to come off of my tongue to say I was a politician. That was a kind of a dirty word. and now, you know, 10 years later, I can say that there are those politicians that give it a bad name, but I think by and large most people that are in politics are public servants and you know, try to do a good job. There are those individuals that are in it for them, you know, and those are the ones that give politicians a bad name.
So when you ran for town councilor, did you that's the first thing you ran for, right?
Yes, town councilor.
Did you have an agenda? Did you know what you wanted to see change in the community, or were you doing it more in a sense of I want to serve and I'll see what's needed?
Well, I've always thought that, you know, I've always had more of an environmental agenda. I thought that, you know, municipalities and government have an obligation, or there's a role for them to play in establishing policies that lead the way for business and and the community and residents in general towards certain initiatives. And to me, the environmental front was one of those areas where government could play an important role in demonstrating that our current consumptive society could be much more sustainable, you know, through environmentally friendly practices. And so, yeah, that was part of my motivation for getting involved in government. There are certain things I think that higher governments have to take responsibilities and roles in. And, you know, we live in a democracy, and one of the great things about a democracy is it serves the will of the people. And I think we've seen an environmentally conscious citizenry now. I mean, it, you know, I used to teach a course called the History of the American Environmental Movement. And the environmental movement, you know, it really draws its root from like the Teddy Roosevelt era, where it was more of a leadership down approach. You know, where guys like John Muir and Teddy Roosevelt, and you know, the list goes on of individuals, because one of the ways I used to teach the class was through biographies. But those early leaders were responsible for the creation of the National Park Service, and you know, so many other, the U.S. Geological Survey, and so many of the things that we look at as land management or environmentally environmental programs, and then from that leadership period of top down, you know, in the late 50s, early 60s, it kind of flipped, and the environmental movement became kind of the Rachel Carson Silent Spring reaction, where it was a grassroots movement where the public said, boom, you know, we don't want to put detergents in the waters anymore. You know, the Buffalo River and the Chicago River caught on fire, and people said, you know, no more, we're going to clean up our air and water and stop all this pollution. And so since the 60s, I think you've had a whole generation grow up that's now much more environmentally conscious. And so whether or not you're an environmentalist or you're on the board of directors of a major corporation, you don't want your children or, you know, or the earth to be destroyed for not just altruistic purposes, but again for health and safety reasons as well. It's a fact that all cancer is environmentally induced. You know, it comes from the fact that we drink our milk out of plastic containers and breathe the air we breathe, and you know, and you don't know where it's actually being triggered, but it's all an environmental reason for, and can't, you know, so everyone has a concern whether or not they live next to Love Canal or Onondaga Lake, or they're drinking, they're eating their peanut butter out of a plastic jar. And so, you know, I think the people recognize that today, and so it's easier now, I think, than ever for governments to react, because they're really reacting to the will of the people. And, And, you know, that's one of the things with a democracy. It might be slow to react, but it typically reacts. And so for someone like me, I think I've been able to get elected by people because people are receptive of it now. Mm-hmm. If the message were, no, I want to build a huge factory for economic purposes and, you know, we're all going to get rich, I probably wouldn't get elected. And so I think my timing in that regard is right, because people, I have a background where people say, hey, yeah, his background fits and this is what we want.
It's kind of like history makes the the person in a sense.
Yeah, in this particular case, yeah.
Yeah. So you have this, it seems like, you know, throughout your passion, or what it seems to me you've been entrepreneurial about, is how to make the environment cleaner, safer. And it's led you through a bunch of jobs and positions, into higher education, and but also into government, into politics.
Well, yeah, and this place as well. I mean, I've been here now 7 years, and we're solely soft-funded. We exist on grants. And I tell the staff all the time, we're only as good as our next idea. But we have to be relevant and productive, and we have to deliver on the grants, because no one's going to give you another one if you don't. Don't deliver on the first one. And so almost all the work we do is, you know, in the areas of research, education, and remediation, but they all have application to issues that are relevant to this community and to today's world. And so we're looking at things like mercury in the food chain, and we're doing planning for, you know, the urban corridor and some of our most depressed neighborhoods. How can Onondaga Creek help revitalize the community? But not only is it going to provide environmental benefits, but social and economic returns to the some of our most blighted neighborhoods and through the south side and the core of the city. And you know, so yeah, I try to look at it, being an ecologist. Systems are whole.
So you have a PhD in ecology?
Well, it's, yeah, soil ecology.
Soil
ecology. My study was a study of the Salve waste beds, and I looked at the physical, biological, and chemical characteristics of those waste beds in terms of over time, in terms of its natural recovery. And the whole reason and purpose of the study was, how do you take distressed or environmentally perturbed lands and restore them? We're still working on a project now, studying that. How do we, if it was an easy question, it would have been done a long time ago, but the waste beds have sat for 100 years now and still aren't you know, a naturally stable system, because it hasn't recovered yet.
Would you call that a brownfield, or is that something?
Yes, yeah, so in the sense of a natural brownfield, it would, because these were lands that were just laid waste and nothing was constructed on them. Where brownfield would be the actual factory or facilities that at one time performed them in the, you know, the industrial operation.
So these, they were just they were marshlands or something? Or
they were lands around Onondaga Lake. When you go to the state fair, if you park your car, you're parking on waste beds.
Oh, okay.
Those waste beds are the byproduct of a soda ash manufacturing facility that was largely responsible for the industrial development of Central New York. And
soda ash was used for?
Soda ash was used in everything.
Okay.
It's an intermediated product in the chemical industry. People don't realize it, but the birthplace of the organic chemical industry is right here in Syracuse. But there was a couple of Belgian brothers, and they owned a process, they invented a chemical process that created the soda ash over in Europe. And what you needed was limestone, salt, and water. And you burned coal to melt the limestone and then combine it with the chlorine, or the, excuse me, the sodium of the
salt.
Salt. and they had all this extra chloride, and so they didn't know what to do with it, and they had all this extra coal waste from burning it. They didn't know what to do with it, and so the chemists in the labs here, especially post-war, World War II, started playing with it, and they combined the chlorines with the coal tar waste, and they invented things like PCBs and dioxins, and although never manufactured here. From a chemist's perspective, those compounds were beautiful. They were so stable. The thing that made them environmental disasters was the attraction in terms of making them, because they were used in electrical generating facilities as capacitors, and you know, they won't explode, they won't burn, they wouldn't break down. So once you put them there, they didn't have to continually, they didn't volatilize. Or once you put them in place, replenishing them was, and maintaining them was relatively cheap and safe. No one realized that they caused neurological damage or had toxicological or reproductive effects. They didn't realize once they threw them out in the environment that they build up in food chains, and so they were just a chemist's dream from a production and industrial standpoint. Turned out to be an environmental disaster, and so, but they were discovered right here in Syracuse, and then later the rights or patents were sold to Monsanto, and then General Electric was the big user. In fact, the chlorobenzenes were made here that were the feedstocks to the Monsanto company that made the PCBs.
I used to work in a plastics factory, doing plastic injection molding, and we, a lot of this sounds familiar. You know, one of the things that's really interesting listening to you here is, oftentimes when you think about entrepreneurship, it's in a business for profit sense, and the focus is on the profit and creating something out of nothing. But what you've just described is something very entrepreneurial. There's a creation of a chemical that that or a product that has many uses and is very good, but then there are all these latent effects, side effects, and your entrepreneurship is, in a sense, a counterbalance.
I worked at O'Brien and Gear for 4 years, and one of my criticisms there, and I had some, I don't want to badmouth the company.
Do you want me to pause it?
One of my criticisms was that the profit motive drove the company, and there seemed to be a lost focus on good engineering. In fact, over 50% of the company was the human resources department, the communications department, the marketing department, the bookkeepers, and so they were a company that was out to make money, and it didn't matter if they made widgets or the goal was to make money, and like I say, they lost. I felt that for a period of time, maybe it's returned, because there were good forces there. There were some very good engineers, but it just seemed like they had lost focus, and it wasn't a concern about good engineering. And so when I came here, one of the things that, and we struggle with it because it's hard to achieve, but we try to do excellent work. Our focus is, to take a project from start to finish and deliver something that's of extremely high quality, whether it be an educational piece or whether it be a research piece or something. We've just got done doing a 303D analysis, which is a section of the Clean Water Act for the state of New York and the EPA. We did this work on behalf of the Onondaga Nation using EPA funds, but we feel like the project has very good utility for the state of New York. Our whole role in that project was to give the DEC the information they needed to make defensible decisions about what they listed as a distressed body of water in central New York, in the Onondaga Lake watershed. And so we did a real extensive review, and I think it was very high quality work. It was mainly done by two colleagues next door, Don Hughes, who's a chemist, PhD, and Dan Gefell, who's a biologist. And like I say, that's our goal here, is to do that kind of work. Right now, I'm spending a ton of time reviewing. I'll show you a document that I think is publishable. This is a side project to the Onondaga Creek Revitalization Plan. And the next things I got to get to review are starting the persons of that document. This is like my third edit round on this document, but this is a case studies document of river revitalizations. And then we looked at the Bronx River, the South Platte in Denver, and the Guadalupe in San Jose. And these, you know, this document, I'm thinking of approaching a publisher when it's done, because I think it's going to be good enough to be a coffee table piece. You know, or people that are interested in river revitalizations. At the end, we've done a little section here where can almost be used by people in courses and colleges and stuff like that too, as again a case study. But there's a dozen different systems here all around the country that have undergone revitalization efforts like we're trying to promote here at Onondaga Creek. And it just gives a little summary of the project and what it's about, and then some other places you can find information on the web regarding those sites. And so, anyways, like I say, this is an educational piece, and I think it's going to have some utility. I hope that we do get this published. But
is that along the line? You said you had published it was a very impressive amount of things. Do you have other publications around, like books and new books and stuff around here?
Something that I do. You know, I don't. I probably have all that stuff at home.
Sure, can I probably just Google?
Yeah. This is something that actually I've edited that as well. I didn't really start. There's sections in there I've written, but I never put myself out as author. I did an editor. But the, you know, I got my thesis here.
I can Google things, and you know, it's not central to what we're doing. One thing you talked about, you know, to be a little earlier, you know, sort of to be in business, you've got to keep coming up with new ideas, innovative things. And how does that work? How do you come up with new ideas? I'm getting a feel for the types of projects that you do.
Well, here's a classic example. In the 303D lit review, we looked at bacteria data. And in Onondaga Creek, in the tributaries to Onondaga Lake, and we discovered that the lake, or the tributary, Onondaga Creek, was out of compliance almost 80% of the time. And the community spending $500 million on CSO control facilities that were designed to stop the bacteria problem in Onondaga Creek. The assumption by Onondaga County and the Water Environment Protection Bureau, which is part of the county government, used to be their drainage and sanitation department, was that the bacteria in the tributaries was a result of storm waters that would combine in the sanitary sewer system and overflow in what we call a combined sewer overflow during wet weather periods. And our analysis quickly looked and said, that's not the case. There are wet weather discharges, but even if you spend this $500 million on these facilities, you're not going to bring this creek into compliance with the Clean Water Act, because 80% of the time it's still, you know, it's still dry weather. And so anyways, we looked at that analysis, and now we have a proposal into the Onondaga Lake Partnership and EPA, and I don't know if we'll get funding for it, but that said, we need to identify the sources of this dry weather releases. We think, and most likely, is leaky source from an old decaying infrastructure in the city, and that the groundwater is contaminated through these leaky sewers in dry weather periods, and the facilities were designed with the idea that, again, it was just this wet weather. It was designed by the county, for the county, that collects the sewers. Mm-hmm. But they never looked down the streets, and the street sewers are owned by the city. And so the county designed the system for them by just looking at their system and never working with the city or looking at the city.
Right.
And so we've caught a lot of flack for it, but it's a high-profile issue in front of the media. We've taken a lower profile. It's our data and our analysis, but Joni Mahoney, Atlantic States Legal Foundation, and the city of Syracuse and Onondaga Nation and Onondaga County are now discussing with New York State the Clinton Regional Treatment Facility that was planned is probably not going to occur. Unfortunately, our analysis came after they built the Midland facility, which was $150 million boondoggle at this point.
Yeah, it's. I mean, what's the status of that?
The state and the county have got $150 million in it. They're probably going to proceed and put the thing online, but they're not going to have an impact on the environment. They wasted their money, in my opinion. And, you know, there were people in the community, like the Partnership for Onondaga Creek and the poor residents of the South Side, that were out there clamoring, saying, you know, this was a bad idea. But in general, the suburban population didn't get affected by it.
Right.
Now the suburban population is going to have to pay for it.
Right.
And it, unfortunately, it was one of those things that the media or nobody really picked up on. And, but that's what we do in terms of trying to make our research relevant.
Right.
So now we've got a proposal out on the table that says we've got to separate and identify the sources of bacteria. We know, based on the county's own monitoring, a good amount of bacteria is coming into the city from the rural areas. Is it septic? Is it agricultural? No one knows. You know, but there's and then, but
the, is it because it's a lower lying area, or is it through the
could be through rural septic systems. You know, areas like Lafayette and Tully, their houses could be draining the bacteria into the creek, and then it's carried down and through the city. And, you know, that's an unhealthy situation. And if people are going to, we're trying to revitalize the creek on one hand, and here we are saying, oh, revitalizing the creek, we're going to have canoeists and kayakers and people approach the water, fishermen and stuff. And then on the other hand, we've got this sewer condition that makes it an unhealthy and unsafe situation for people to contact the water. And so, you know, again, being an ecologist, you got to look at this from a whole system standpoint, a big picture, and say, you know, what do we want as a community? Do we want a clean, healthy system? And so now the research side says we've got to go in and identify the sources of bacteria, and we have to shut them down. And then, like I say, then there's the public education side that says these are issues, and we need to get this out to the public and and let them chew on them and make decisions. And the creek was originally straightened and turned into a channel to flush the sewer house out. Prior to sewer treatment in the old 1800s, you built the street, you put your sewer pipes in, and you know, with the onset of indoor running water, they just flushed it out to the creek. Well, the creek was a normal natural creek, and in the summer months the sewage just sat there on the stones. You know, if you go by the Delaware River when you drive home to Brooklyn, you know how the Delaware sits there and stuff? Well, with low water periods, the sewage would sit there at the edge of the creek. They they channelized the creek to make the sewage flush to the lake, get it out of the system so it wouldn't stink all summer.
That's
so that's why later it turned into flood control. But the initial reason for channelizing creeks in an urban corridor was to flush your flush your toilets. Nobody nobody really thinks about those things. And so, you know, the creek has long been bacterial. So we've got almost 100 years of bacterial contamination in the creek, and one of the first steps to bringing it back is stop that.
Wow. So what initially got you interested in the, when you started teaching, was it high school?
Biology and chemistry.
At that point, were you very interested in the environment?
Yes, and so that's
was something before that?
Yeah, I just always. One of my original things as a kid, I thought I was going to be a forester.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I had this idea of that I was going to be a hermit and live mm-hmm. out in the mm-hmm. woods. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then you get older and more mm-hmm. mature. Now I look back at life and I realize, you know, some of my greatest mm-hmm. enjoyment is with people.
Mm-hmm. And,
but as a young person growing mm-hmm. up, I said, well, I'd love to live mm-hmm. out in the...
Mm-hmm.
The Grizzly Adams life.
Yeah.
But that, yeah. But so I was going to be a forester. So even when, and then when I went to school and became a high school biology and chemistry teacher, it was always an environmental focus.
Mm-hmm.
I taught biology, you know, the New York State syllabus, and mm-hmm. one of the frustrations was that it was heavily weighted towards physiology and anatomy.
Yeah.
And, you know, the sections on trees and plants, or, you know, even the animal kingdom or living things was relatively limited.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it wasn't that focus. And so I went back for my master's to further understand the environment.
Mm-hmm.
I always felt if you're going to be an environmentalist, you've got to understand the system. You can't fix something if you don't understand mm-hmm. how it works.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to school to, and I got my master's in environmental ed and communications, but I really went there with the focus of being a naturalist.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went and got my doctorate after that, and it really turned further into a deep chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And, I kind of took all the tools that I had in my earlier studies and kind of wrapped them in, again, that connection between biology and chemistry and the environment.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's worth noting is when I went to Cortland State and I got my undergraduate degree, I wasn't sure if I was going to be a good teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And so I paralleled a chemical engineering degree.
Mm-hmm.
Cortland didn't offer one, but I took all, you know, 3 years of calculus and mm-hmm. some physics and mm-hmm. the engineering, the chemistry course. I kept going into my advisor, and you know, I was in a teacher's ed program, and I would sign up for a class like P chemistry, mm-hmm. physical chemistry, and he'd say, "You don't have to take that."
Uh-huh.
I said, but I want to. Uh-huh. The guy would think I was nuts.
Uh-huh.
Going and took my third year of calculus.
Uh-huh.
What are you signing up for that for? You don't need to take calculus.
Uh-huh.
And so anyways, like I say, all that I think helped me mm-hmm. in the end to get a good understanding of how the environment works. I mean, I think I've never been tremendously focused on one individual topic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's I think the environment and the ecosystem has always been my topic.
Mm-hmm.
To me, of great interest is this global, what they're calling global warming, really is misnomer. It's climate change.
Mm-hmm.
It's unfortunate that it got the title of global warming,
mm-hmm.
because if you're sitting in a cold pocket of air right now,
yeah.
two air masses aren't mixing.
Uh-huh.
You've got density gradients. It's
mm-hmm.
in many respects driven by particulate matter and CO2 gases.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're going to either be hot or you're going to be cold.
Mm-hmm.
And the violent forces between the two, you know, it's strange, but we're getting more and more snowstorms that show up with lightning. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, did you call last week seeing this snowstorm pull in and it was thunder and lightning coming?
And I was like, was that lightning? And
yeah.
But I didn't see any more, so
it was a couple hits that came with it. But you know, I think those kinds of climate change
mm-hmm.
are real, and it you know, the debate is more about the effect of
mm-hmm.
human impact on it
mm-hmm.
and everything. But I do believe that there's an environmental relationship there between human activity and
mm-hmm.
the climate change
mm-hmm.
that we're experiencing. As we've logged off huge amounts of the rainforests and the oxygen that was put out by those trees, and
mm-hmm.
now this CO2 and just the heat sinks, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What used to be cool is warming up because the rainforest had a cooling effect.
Mm-hmm.
And so now the equator's turned more into a desert desert process. And at some point in time down our future, you know, the Amazon might look like the Sahara.
But big issues.
Yeah.
To where, and it was your love of the outdoors, sort of. You want what led you to? I mean, I remember taking calculus, and I wasn't. I don't know that I would have taken more for the fun of it. Did you feel like it was very important to understanding this environmental world or what?
Well, yes. Part of it, you know, the calculus went alongside the chemistry in terms of understanding chemical half-lives and stuff. You know, but if you've got so much of a... I always looked for practical applications to... You know, I always thought that was one of the failures of education, is that you teach a course, so the course, if it didn't relate to the student, then... You know, if they didn't understand how in the world it worked, then what was it, you know, a differential equation, it didn't mean anything if I didn't have an application I could apply it to. And so, for most students, chemistry, you know, calculus and things of that nature didn't have a practical application.
Sounds good. Well, getting close to when I should leave, but what are some of the accomplishments you're most proud of? You listed a bunch, but I don't want to be the one who picks. You know, somebody said, what have you done that was really worthwhile? Things are glad you did.
Well, you know, some of the simple stuff is gratifying as well. I mean, I drive down Jamesville Road, I was the person that fought for sidewalks. You know, but when that project first came to town board, the board's mindset was that sidewalks were a liability, that no one was going to maintain or take care of them, that they were an expense to the town, and those are all legitimate issues, because if someone does hurt themselves on the sidewalk, they're likely to sue the homeowner in the town and everything. But I saw it again as more of a way of giving the adjacent neighborhoods access to PNC and to Mario and Salvo's Pizza and things of that nature, where if you're Mario's, there was a lot of sides of it. You know, young children could go get an ice cream, they could get a pizza, they can get bread and milk for their mom. You know, but on top of that, those stores that have limited parking spaces in those plazas probably struggle. And so if 5 or 10% of their business walks in off the street and doesn't have to worry about the parking space, that could be their profit margin. You know? And so it was a way of keeping those plazas economically viable as well. And then, again, the environmental side is it reduces cars and fossil fuel consumption if people start to walk. And so there's so many reasons for them. So something simple like a sidewalk is the type of thing that
I can thank you for that. I use it all the time. I run through there. Actually, you know, in the sun, in the warmer weather, we'll take walks to the park right by the school, and then go eat at a restaurant there or get some things at PNC, and then walk home. And then it connects with the new sidewalk past Wegmans to the canal.
Those are mine as well.
Those are yours as well. Oh, well, thanks a lot. I would have liked to ask for a raised, you know, I know they were expensive, you know, so I don't have to cross the traffic.
Bridge. Yeah.
But yeah, bridge. Like,
well,
you know,
we'll
like
keep working on that kind of stuff. Right now, one of my plans is to get, you know, where the canal feeder is? But when you get to Butternut Drive at Pickwick, on Genesee Street, if you're walking towards Wegmans, out of our neighborhood, there's a like a little barbershop and a hair salon right there in an orange brick building, and you enter Pickwick, and then Butternut Road wraps around and goes along
to the Agway
Meadowbrook. Meadowbrook. But what I'm hoping to do is get a parking there's really informal parking there now, but you can park on that curve before...
This is the one that comes around toward the old Agway building.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You can park on that curve now. What I want to get is a trailhead right there. And then if you look across the what's the Meadowbrook feeder that goes right. down in the Meadowbrook. Uh-huh. There is perfect location for a trail there now.
The right-of-way for the electricity?
Yes, but over the canal, if you just look over the water, there's a guardrail along the road right now, and a row of trees, and then there's a ditch, basically.
Yeah.
That ditch is Meadowbrook.
Yeah.
You know the Meadowbrook that goes through the cemetery?
Which cemetery?
St. Mary's?
Yes.
On Genesee Street?
Uh-huh.
There's a creek in there, Meadowbrook.
Uh-huh.
Yes, that's Meadowbrook Drive. If you drive towards the city, Meadowbrook Drive or Nottingham High School,
right?
The Meadowbrook comes down, and then it goes under Jamesville Road. When you drive towards Randall Road, you go over a bridge.
Yes, that's the same
one. Beautiful little ravine in there with a creek in it. That's Meadowbrook. And then that comes down to 481.
And then crosses.
And at that point in time, it got channelized because they built the highway.
Right.
And so they just stuck that channel along there, and there's a bank on the other side of the channel.
Yep.
I want to get a trail all the way back towards Kinney Road.
Kinney.
Get back to Kinney Road again there.
Mm-hmm.
We want to connect, you know, and then you got the canal park that runs all the way east.
Yeah.
We want to try to connect all that together.
Uh-huh.
And I don't want to go further south along the highway.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got a little pocket park that I've been working on, Fiddler's Green, up in Jamesville.
Okay.
Right behind the Glenlock.
Oh, yeah.
That's going to be a town park.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so we want to connect all the way through from Jamesville, the village of Jamesville. There's, when 173 remodeled, the state DOT had original plans to raise the road up in front of, you know where the village eatery is?
Oh, it sounds very familiar. It's on the way out to Jamesville.
Or the village hardware store. There's a little hardware store in village. If you come up North Street along the railroad tracks and you hit Route 173, there's a flower shop in front of you, and then you kind of go up over the railroad tracks.
Okay.
Right off to the right is a hardware store. The left, excuse me, is a hardware store, and then just beyond that was a little diner eatery. The state DOT had plans to put the road, because see, all the highway departments do is want to move cars. So they built the road 7 feet higher. We're talking about my accomplishments then.
Right, yeah.
They wanted to bring the road up 7 feet higher. And what I did was able to keep the road at grade, which I believe saved those businesses, because 7 feet higher would have destroyed those businesses.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they had 5 lanes of traffic crossing Butternut Creek. And what we were able to do was turn that back into just a couple lanes of traffic with a turning lane and put a pocket park. So if you drive to Jamesville to Route 91 right now, just off to the right before you turn down 91 South to go to Pompeii, there's a little pocket park there with parking spaces for fishing access, or you could picnic there or whatever. But that's the original trailhead that I want to get down along Butternut Creek all the way into Town Hall.
Oh, wow, wow.
But someday, it's my hope that I can take... I want to turn Butternut Creek into our Central Park, because I want to stop development along the creek. One, you'll ruin it, but you'll end up with an Onondaga Creek or a Bronx River or something. And then, so we have all this green space around it now. I want to preserve that, so I want to aggressively go after acquiring the land and building trail systems and park systems along the creek. That someday DeWitt will have, you know. Because someday, you know, you look 100 years from now, it's going to be all developed.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, if we don't set it aside now, it's not going to happen.
Well, that is very exciting to me. Anything coming? What's not coming online next? You know, in a few months. No,
all this is going to take time and money.
What you've done is very appreciated, because in many suburban areas, there is no connection. You have to ride on a main road, ride your bike, or run.
The Genesee Street project was mine. I went to the state and said, make that 3 lanes, because we got the shoulders in place and the sidewalks. But I pushed those sidewalks and those shoulders. Because now, eventually, I don't know if I'll ever get this, but eventually I want to turn those shoulders into bike lanes. I'm hoping that we go through the town of DeWitt and we turn all our major roads with a blue stripe, mm-hmm. and inside the blue stripe is a bike lane, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. so that we can educate people to. One of the things I do in the summer months, I don't do it now, I have my wife, she works at the hospital, drop me off in the morning. Mm-hmm. We have no shower facilities here, so I can't do it here, mm-hmm. but I take a bicycle home. Mm-hmm.
Huh. And, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So it's only 7 miles.
Yeah.
Navigating through central New York. And one of the discouraging things is I have no problems in the city uh-huh. riding a bicycle. Motorists really? In the city, yeah. in neighborhoods here. Accept that.
Yeah.
You get to DeWitt and they want to kill you.
Yeah.
You know?
Everybody's going fast.
And, yeah, and yeah. everybody's a bicyclist in the suburbs yeah. is a foreign thing. You
yeah.
know? They just
yeah.
kind of don't think of that. So I want to, again, as part of the mm-hmm. environmental movement, mm-hmm. and reduce the need for, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, automobiles, mm-hmm. is to make things more bike and pedestrian friendly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To make communities like more like Brooklyn,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and bring the stoops back, you know.
Yeah,
but
that's what I was asking him to do. He's building this new building. I'm like, can't you put stoops in?
Yeah, right. But huh. but you know, that does make mm-hmm. again, I think, more of a friendly community. Well, I selected our home and our neighborhood because I could do those things. We mm-hmm. can walk to Shopping Town. We can mm-hmm. walk to PNC. We can walk to Mario and Salvo's, mm-hmm. and we can walk to get an ice cream. Mm-hmm. And I can walk to a dark room and have a drink.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have to worry about DWI. Oh,
the dark horse? The
yeah. It used to be the dark room.
Yeah. Yeah, we said, when the kids get old enough, yeah. we'll do that, yeah.
My youngest is 18 right uh-huh. now.
Oh, he's my gosh.
Just, yeah, so we're just empty uh-huh. nesting, uh-huh. and that's why I mentioned that, because uh-huh. I haven't done it in 20, 30
yeah,
years. But
yeah,
I'm looking
yeah.
forward to yeah. walking down there and uh-huh. having a drink at night and uh-huh. coming back.
It's nice to have a walking place. I've got to start backing up. Yeah. Definition of social entrepreneurship, if you have one. What would you think? The idea is, I'm looking for variation in what people say. What would you think a social entrepreneur is? Or
a social entrepreneur is, yeah. I think, someone that can do those things, you know, is make, in my case, environmental, economic, and social improvements for the mm-hmm. community.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think the three are connected.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. That was great. All right. Great. Thanks.